Presenting
The Complete
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
This is Orson Welles speaking from London.
As the third man.
Stand by.
We'll be on the air in 15 seconds, Mr. Welles.
Yes, I know.
Stand by, everybody.
Mercury Theater on the air presents Orson Welles as Count Dracula in his own version of Bram Stoker's great novel, Dracula.
What evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Hello, world. Welcome to The Complete Orson Welles, brought to you by Duane Oldtime Radio. This podcast will feature various classic radio programs ranging mostly from 1936 to 1952 that Orson either produced and directed, was featured on, or starred as a guest. Thank you for your support. Hope you enjoy The Genius of Mr. Welles. This week on The Complete Orson Welles, by me, Duane, Oldtime Radio, we have two episodes of the Orson Welles commentaries. The seventh episode, this one is titled Williams Hall, the guest host talks of brewing civil war in China, October 28th, 1945. Then we have their eighth episode, OSS, and this one is about the future CIA and possible war with Russia, November 4th, 1945.
Here is Williams Hall with the latest news. Mr. Hall is substituting this morning for Orson Welles, who is suffering from laryngitis. We'll get to the news in just a moment. It won't be long before you'll be seeing many new radio sets in the stores again. And among them will be one kind you'll find especially good. You may not have seen its name before, but actually this name has been on the very finest types of radios for more than 15 years. The name is Lear, L-E-A-R. And the radios it's been on since 1930 have been radios for aircraft. Aircraft radios have such an important job to do that the most advanced engineering, the finest materials, and the most expert craftsmanship are required in building them. This is the kind of manufacture that Lear knows. It's the kind that has become ingrained in Lear. This is why you hear people say, Lear is the name men fly by. Now, Lear is making home radios. And just as you would expect, these radios are as fine, as dependable, as high in quality as Lear knows how to make them. In Lear radios, you find the newest developments. To mention one, there's the Lear wire that remembers. This is a simple way to make lasting records of the good times you have, the songs of the children, the talents of your friends. Or you can record radio programs right from the air. These recordings can be just a few words, or they can be hours long. You can play them and replay them over and over indefinitely. Or if you don't want to keep them, you wipe them off the wire simply by recording something else. Radios have never had anything like this before. It's one of the reasons you'll want your radio to be a Lear radio. Now, Williams Hall, substituting for Mr. Welles, brings you the latest news. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
Civil war is said to be raging in northeast and central China. A Chinese communist spokesman has told foreign correspondents of civil warfare in 11 provinces. And Chongqing reports say central government troops and Chinese communist forces are engaged in daily skirmishes in Shaanxi province. Marshal Yan Shishan, Chongqing appointed Shaanxi governor, says daily clashes have been going on for the past 12 weeks and that the situation approaches a state of undeclared civil war. The 63-year-old marshal says government forces have suffered 2,000 casualties in September and October during the battle for Changxin in southeastern Shaanxi. Marshal Yan claims that the communists had gathered a force of 64 regiments before they seized the strategic city. The aging marshal has returned to Chongqing for the first time in 8 years to report to Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek in person. He says there are records of 40 to 50 engagements in a single day. Well, that is one side of the story, and now here's the other. The New China Daily, a communist newspaper, flatly accuses the Chung government with the employment of 800,000 troops against Red Armies in northern and eastern China. Reports from Admiral Barbie's flagship off Hulutau, Manchuria, says Chinese communist soldiers have taken shots at one of the admiral's barges. The American barge was driven away from the barricaded Hulutau pier, by a shower of rifle bullets from gray-uniformed communist troops. The commander of the Chinese Communist Fourth Army at Hulutau has formally apologized to Vice Admiral Barbie, and the incident has been smoothed out. But observers point out, this too tells of the tense situation in China and indicates communist determination to hold their own against Chiang Kai-shek or even American intervention if it should come. While this has been happening in China, reports from Bombay tell of continued political unrest in India. The Indian Congress Party shows no inclination to rest until British control of India comes to an end. As a matter of fact, it has passed a resolution demanding that the British quit India. This declaration says, the Indian Congress Party's primary object and paramount duty is to benefit the masses by raising the economic, cultural, and spiritual levels and removing unemployment. The resolution also says that the Congress Party is in favor of a world federation of free nations and would back world peace and cooperation. But they argue, and we quote again, only on the basis of freedom and elimination of imperialism everywhere can world peace be established. Political unrest also prevails in Europe. A spokesman for Julius Maneu, the Romanian Peasant Party leader, told reporters in London that there is no constitutional government in Romania today. He charged that the present Groza government is not qualified to rule. Maneu's London spokesman added that the absence of normal relations between the king and the government has created what he calls an absurd situation. The Groza regime has denied such allegations. Supporters of the Groza government have claimed that Maneu represents reactionary interests, those sections of the Romanian people who allegedly wish to return to the old days, which supposedly served only the interest of the privileged class. At the same time, the Swiss radio reports that Prime Minister Groza has announced that democratic national elections will be held in the near future. Groza has pledged himself not to touch British and American capital should he be returned to office. While all these reports add up into an ever-growing need for an international forum to iron out these differences, we receive word that the United Nations organization has made another step forward. The first General Assembly of the Global Peace Forum is expected to be held at London during the first week of January. The governments and leaders of the world are giving a lot of thought to President Truman's Navy Day declaration on United States foreign policy. American commentators in general praise the president's summary of American foreign policy. Most of them say the speech heralds full American cooperation in the preservation of future world peace. Diplomatic observers in Washington are agreed that it was an excellent statement of broad United States objectives. Some, however, were uncertain of the reception Mr. Truman's policy statement would get abroad, especially from nations with whom relations are strained. The London Sunday newspapers welcome the president's assertion that strong American forces will be maintained to avoid future wars. The Sunday Dispatch says the speech contains, and we quote, much that is hopeful, accompanied perhaps inevitably by material that will prompt renewed speculation. British political sources regard the Navy Day pronouncement as notice to the world that the United States intends to stand firm in her present position. Some London sources show disappointment at the lack of specific detail. They point out that Mr. Truman gave no hint as to whether the Big Three have agreed on how to revive the Foreign Minister's Council. The Russian newspapers prominently carry the president's address. A full resume is given and a text of 12 points of American foreign policy is printed. But so far, there has been no editorial comment. Soviet sources point out that Generalissimo Joseph Stalin, within the past year, has asserted that the wartime coalition should be able to organize peace. It is predicted in Moscow that important developments will soon come from United States Ambassador Harriman's recent visit to Premier Stalin in his vacation retreat. The French Sunday newspapers agree with President Truman's foreign policy outline. Some are critical of his revelation that America intends to keep the secrets of the atomic bomb. They suggest that if the world's riches are to be at the disposal of all peoples, as the president suggested, then the secrets of atomic energy should be shared. A French leftist paper said, nobody can contest the generosity and idealism of Truman's 12 points, but let us wait until Truman translates his words into acts. The resistance newspaper Combat said, "The speech seems above reproach when it gives a new and welcome publicity to the Atlantic Charter. It appears the president doesn't intend to reveal the atom bomb secret at present, so a certain awkwardness hovers over his words." A conservative Paris paper finds encouragement in United States reaffirmation that she has neither territorial or aggressive intentions. But some French sources show disappointment that President Truman says nothing definite about American policy toward Germany or Indochina. Some Swedish observers compared Mr. Truman's 12 points to the late President Wilson's 14 points. They praise what they call the straightforwardness and uncompromising idealism the president showed. Other Swedish sources believe the Navy Day statement was meant to inform Russia directly of American foreign policy. And they also predict Premier Stalin may make a similar Soviet policy announcement in his November 7th speech. From Jerusalem, the Palestine Post comments that the president's words, along with declarations by England's Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin last Friday, indicate a common statement of Western principles. The paper says Truman's points not only warn Russia and check enthusiasm within the Soviet orbit, but reassure a large part of the world concerning the reality of the American attitude. Now for a glance at home front developments. In Washington, the Army announces that it will demobilize and convert to peacetime basis its worldwide weather service for the Air Forces. Originally costing $40 million at its peak, the Air Force's weather service contained 857 observation and forecasting stations. The 17,800 men who man these global units will be reduced and the foreign units turned over to the countries in which they are located. On Capitol Hill, Senator McMahon, the chairman of the Senate Atomic Energy Committee, says his group will meet for the first time next Tuesday. Dr. Morris Perlman, a prominent physicist, told fellow members of the Los Alamos Atomic Bomb Project that in a future war, a nation might suffer decisive damage before learning the identity of its attackers. And as a safeguard, Perlman urged a strong international authority as the only way to control atomic weapons of war. The auto industry is waiting for labor's answer to a compromise proposal on union demands for a 30% wage lift. The vice president of the CIO United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, is expected to reply today to General Motors' suggestion that workers settle for a 45-hour week with a 6% wage boost for straight-time work. This would be only for the duration of the reconversion period. Observers believe this suggestion, originating with GM President C.E. Wilson, probably will be turned down, mainly because labor fought long and hard for the present 40-hour week and wouldn't want to give it up. The General Motors president recognized this fact and said labor's first impression probably would be that it is a reactionary idea, not in the interest of labor. However, he added, it's no more reactionary than working longer hours in the war emergency. Wilson went on to say that the present overtime pay of 50% on extra hours over 40 discourages employers and business generally from planning such extra hours of production. Therefore, he pointed out, production would tend to be reduced at a time when American and world markets are clamoring for peacetime products to fill a long pent-up demand. In conclusion, the General Motors chief executive said that if a 40-hour week proved sound in pre-war days and a 48-hour week was good during the war, a 45-hour week would be just as sound for the reconversion period. And now your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Lear has been making fine radios since 1930, aircraft radios. During all that time, Lear developed techniques of fine manufacture that are now benefiting the new Lear home radios. When you see and hear these Lear home radios, you'll say to yourself, what wonderful instruments. And you'll be absolutely right. For there'll be a whole line of sets, handsome and capable. Some will have television. Some will include high-fidelity, static-free FM. There will be models with record players and automatic record changers. And some will have the Lear wire recorder I mentioned a little while ago. But with all these features and with their unusual excellence of manufacture, Lear radios are not high in price. They range from a top of about $500 for a masterpiece console combination to about $19.95 for a smart, efficient table model. Of course, the best way to see what Lear has done for home radio is to hear the news sets themselves. We expect you'll be able to do that before the holiday buying season. We'll keep you posted. Because we know when you look at and listen to a Lear radio, you'll be convinced that here is a radio that gives you more value for every dollar you pay. The Lear Radio. L-E-A-R. And now, a final word from Williams Hall, substituting for Orson Welles.
Here is a brief resume of this morning's news highlights. Civil warfare is reported raging in 11 provinces in northeast and central China. A communist newspaper charges that the Chongqing forces are using some 800,000 troops against the communists. Overseas reactions to President Truman's foreign policy speech are generally favorable. Russian newspapers are carrying the full text of Mr. Truman's speech without comment. Observers predict that Marshal Stalin will state the Soviet position in his speech on November 7th. The Auto Workers Union is expected to give a negative answer today to the General Motors plan.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.
10:30 at KECA, Los Angeles. Stay tuned to this station for Orson Welles.
Orson Welles speaking. I've got a spy story for you today, a word from Washington, and some true confessions about the Martian broadcast. I'll get to that in just a minute.
Literally, millions of people are waiting to buy a new radio for their homes, waiting to see what the sets to come are going to be like. Of course, everyone knows that some of these sets will be put together by companies who have never made radios before, but who want to cash in on the big demand. Others will be made by old-timers, able to pick up manufacture where they left off in 1942. But as far as we know, no other manufacturer shares the unique position of Lear. Lear has built radios since 1930, the most exacting radios, radios for aircraft. To be acceptable, they had to be the finest radios that could be made. And Lear has become known as the name men fly by. So Lear's experience has been at the top level of radio design and manufacture. Now, Lear is putting Lear foresight and know-how into home radios. Just for example, one of the new things you'll find in Lear radios is the Lear wire that remembers, a method of recording on wire that's built right into the set. Snap a switch and you make a lifelike record of your children's songs, your own talents, or even a radio program taken right off the air. This record can be a few minutes or more than an hour long. It can be replayed for a lifetime. Yet, whatever you don't want to keep can be erased by merely recording something else right over it. There's never been anything like this in home radios before. So before you settle on any radio for your home, be sure to see the one with the nameplate Lear, L-E-A-R. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
Exclusive from Washington. The State and War Departments have just declined to absorb the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. I guess they figure all those spies are too tough to handle. A high source in Washington told me this morning that an executive order will shortly set up the Cloak and Dagger outfit as a new independent agency. Here's a story we couldn't tell until now. It's a swell plot for the movies, but you can take it the way I'm giving it to you. Neat. It's perfectly true. Soon after we ended the war, an OSS agent infiltrated into Nazi-controlled France. To keep his, the most secret of all missions, he was in contact with only one OSS man in the United States. If he was captured, tortured, he'd then be able to reveal nothing about OSS save the name of his one Washington contact. For a year, he sent out invaluable information, receiving periodic instructions from his Washington contact, but suddenly, he received no more secret orders, no more curt receipts. After a time, concluding his mission was over, he slipped out of France at some peril, made his way back to Washington, reported to OSS, but in the wondrous ways of bureaucracy, his one contact had been fired months before. And when the agent from France claimed to be an OSS man, no one knew him or anything about him. He was promptly clapped into jail and suspected of being a Nazi agent. Not until many weeks elapsed was he able to escape shooting as a Nazi spy by tracing down his one-time contact to prove he was really one of the most valuable of our Cloak and Dagger boys. Well, Russia takes her place this week at the Far Eastern Advisory Commission meetings in the nation's capital. According to unimpeachable State Department sources, it was the Russians who initiated the new discussions, which have led to her joining the Japanese talks. I don't think we need any better proof that Joe Stalin wants to get along with us. Word seeping back to the White House has finally begun to penetrate the closed doors and is finally reaching the ears of the tired, worried occupant of that hardback swivel chair, that famous chair in the chief executive's oval study. Inside the now gleaming, freshly painted presidential offices, there's a cold awareness of the fact that if the United States wants war with Russia, it will make that war all by itself. Russia deposits her formal entry into the United Nations with the State Department. At that same moment, the World Organization springs to life, the seed carefully nurtured under an older and greater president, planted and tenderly, fairly tenderly, cared for on California's jutting San Francisco shale, becomes the world's first faint hope of future peace. The corridors of the State Department and of London's Foreign Office in Whitehall have been buzzing with reports that Russia would bolt the new organization before it was set up. But Russia proves now that she's willing to meet us halfway toward world peace in an organization inside of which she is certain to be badly outvoted. More good news, bad news for the vicious poll tax. Leaders of the anti-poll tax fight are now pretty sure that they're in a position to put the heat on the White House, and they think they can force the administration leaders in the Senate to ram the bill through. Harry Truman, who you know has boasted of how well he gets along with the Southern senators, is waking up to the fact that it's high time he won the support of the Negro voters of America. Just now, I think his stock with Negro voters isn't worth a penny a share. You can bet the poll tax voters will put the issue squarely up to the president. Be a real test of where he stands. Jennings Perry, publisher of the Nashville Tennessean and head of the National Committee to Combat the Poll Tax, said this week that he saw a great contradiction between America's formal intervention abroad to guarantee a free vote when our own country is a classic example of voteless autocracy in many regions. Perry asks what the reaction would be if Bulgaria sent a delegation to the voteless nation's capital and the poll tax-paying South to investigate the absence of free elections in the United States. And speaking of elections, two vital ones affecting the ultimate political destiny of our nation take place day after tomorrow, one in New York, the other in Detroit. Should Manhattan's progressive candidate General O'Dwyer win by the expected overwhelming margin, substantial hustling to the left and a new love for liberalism will be very evident around the White House. Should the progressive candidate in Detroit come through as well, the political forces which won the last presidential election may be able to press those issues on which their candidates, including Mr. Truman, campaigned. Well, we turn now to the fabulous city of Rio. Beautiful Rio, Rio by the Sea. The news from there this week is that Mr. Getulio Vargas lost his job. It was a big job being president of one of the world's biggest countries, and through the years, my friend Mr. Vargas turned it into a much bigger job by throwing away all the ballot boxes in Brazil and going into business for himself. Goodwill ambassadors, like your obedient servant, were cautioned at the American embassy and elsewhere, not to mention the unpleasant word, but the fact is that Getulio was a dictator. I give him his first name, Getulio, not to parade the intimate terms of our friendship, which I'm not particularly proud, but simply because that's the way he's referred to by some 43 million Brasileiros, very few of whom knew the big boss at all. Getulio was always. He's a clever one, this Getulio of ours. You heard that the minute you got off the plane. He doesn't say much, your Brazilian friends will tell you, but he doesn't need to. Not that one, not our slick, shrewd little Getulio. He can be silent in 10 languages. Not only that, they told you he could take off his socks without taking off his shoes. Living in Brazil and in different parts of it, as I did, you got the impression that this dictatorship was being sold to the suckers by charm rather than by demagoguery. And if you got to know Getulio, as I did pretty well, this idea was strengthened. From across the room, the man you met looked like a retired candy manufacturer, a happy, chubby little granddaddy whose declining years were given over to charitable works. His defenders would tell you that this wasn't far from the truth, that under the sunny despotism of the Decada Getuliana, industrial production was increased by 1.485%, that the external debt was reduced, national parks built, highways and airports instituted. You were shown pictures of all these lovely things happening under the benevolent eye of Getulio, and then you got right up close to that eye, the real thing, not a photograph, and caught the glitter, the wily, witty, wicked glitter, the eye of an old crow, as old as sin, nesting on the Sphinx. He always had a joke for me. He knew more gossip than you'd think a dictator could have time for, and he loved mentioning by name my latest date. I was a bachelor in Brazil, to prove he knew everything I was up to. And he did. And speaking of pictures of his good deeds, I remember the night we tried to photograph one of the tenement districts in the favelas, that's the hills above Rio, thugs. Thugs surrounded us, and after a siege of beer bottles, empties, of course, stones, bricks, and I hate to think what else, We retreated to a more photogenic district, clutching our Technicolor cameras as we went. And if you knew the size of the darn things, you'd grant that's no mean trick. Well, Chitulio's partisans used to remind you that he unified the country, but everywhere in the street cafes, the clubs, the universities, I heard Brazilian people grumbling back at this sotto voce. Oh, yes, they said. Of course, there's no unity so perfect as the unity of slaves. Of slaves in a barracoon. The first year or two of the war, that grumbling was still dissipated in those charming jokes. A Brazilian specialty, those jokes. Deflating the object of ridicule, but also lowering the pressure of political discontent. The one about Vargas's picture, for example, that joke. There was a law, up to last week in Brazil, that every place of business must carry on its walls prominently framed the likeness of Getulio. According to the story, Mussolini checks in at the pearly gates of heaven, shows his identification, is tossed out for his presumption by the proper cherubim and seraphim. Then Hitler appears, same thing happens to him. Finally, Vargas presents himself before St. Peter, who goes to the Almighty and says, "You've got to let in Getulio. You've got his picture on your wall." About those jokes, we like to think that satire is a dangerous political weapon in representative government. It is. Under a despotism, it's a safety valve that works the clock around for the despot. Vargas actually hired people to make up those jokes about him. After Brazil ended the war, the people stopped telling jokes. Vargas promised free elections because he had to, promised them for right after VE Day. When he began thinking of declaring war on Japan, Brasileiro said it was a ruse to put off the balloting a little longer. A high-ranking Brazilian government official told me at the Conference of Inter-American States in Mexico last spring that the example of American soldiers voting last fall for a president in all the theaters of war, a spectacle beheld by amazed Brazilian GIs, would cost Vargas his power when those Brazilian GIs returned to Brazil. I printed that prediction in my newspaper column, and this week's flash of the bloodless removal of the smiling Iron Man bears it out. I happen to be intimately acquainted with the men behind the coup. They say their purpose is the guarantee of those elections so long delayed, and although the army figures ominously in the picture, I'll tell you that I'm inclined to be very optimistic. There are many real freedoms in Brazil today. Social freedoms no dictator, however sly, could wipe away. I think these next years will discover a truly democratic Brazil, a valuable friend for our cause in Latin America. My guess is that if we move forward into a free world, Brazil will be marching right along beside us. And that, I think, I hope, winds up the story of the cheerful tyrant from the South. This week retired as plain Mr. Vargas. Moral, the most dangerous dictator is the nicest one. Well, a fine, bounding case of strep throat kept me from calling on you last week, which was closer to Halloween than this is, but we're still close enough, I hope, to that witching season for me to mark an anniversary for the Mercury Theater. It was on Halloween Eve many a weary year ago that we brought before the listening public the first intelligence of a certain interplanetary invasion. Much has happened since then. There were real invasions. One black Sunday morning in December, I was sitting in the newsroom of a radio station when the word came to us about Pearl Harbor. I remember that for a little while, a lot of people thought I was up to my old tricks. I only wish I had been. Well, to be less gloomy, by way of goodbye today, may I please tell you an anecdote or two about the men from Mars. But first, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Up to now, only aviators have had Lear radios. They haven't been made for homes before. But now the engineering, the foresight, the meticulous manufacture that Lear knows so well is going into fine home radios and what sets they are. Beautifully designed and made with a master craftsman's touch. Some include television. Some have record players and automatic record changers. Some have FM worldwide shortwave and the Lear wire recorder I described before. But if you think that radios with all these fine features must cost a lot, just forget it. For these fine Lear radios are right along in price with sets that don't offer nearly so much. There's a good-looking, capable table model at $19.95. And at the other end of the line, there's a beautiful console combination with television, FM, recorder, and everything that sells for about $500. We'll let you know just when you can hear these radios at your Lear dealer studios. Then you can see for yourself how really fine they are. We know you're going to agree that you get the most value for your investment when you buy a radio that carries the name Lear. L-E-A-R. And now a final word from Orson Welles.
Well, that notorious Martian broadcast hit a large number of people in a large number of ways. There was, among other things, a strong revival of religious sentiment, I understand, and the churches were well filled for the whole of that hectic night. My beloved friend Jack Barrymore was taken in by his own account, and when we flashed the word that the men from Mars had taken Princeton and were on their way up Fifth Avenue, Jack went to the kennels at the back of his house, opened the doors, and told a group of bewildered St. Bernard dogs that they had their freedom. And Bing Crosby tells a wonderful story about a famous golfer whose name I'd better withhold because Bing tells me that he'd looked upon the wine, this golfer had looked upon it when it was red and before he started listening to the show. That afternoon, it seems he'd done famously at an important match, some links in New England, and with golfer friends, he was driving back to New York with the radio going on in the car. About the time our radio actor, president, appealed from the White House for the people to keep calm, the notable sportsman gave way to honest tears. "Just think," he said to his colleagues through his racking sobs, "I beat my best score today, and now the world is coming to an end. Nobody will ever know about it. I wish I could tell you more, but it's time to leave you now. Please let me come to call again, and thanks for this time. Till then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radio, I remain, as always, obediently yours."
This is the American Broadcasting Company.
10:30 at KECA, Los Angeles.
Thank you for listening to and showing your support for my podcast. If you would like to receive notifications of when new episodes are posted, please subscribe to my channel. Subscriptions are 100% free, and they really help me get an idea of how I'm doing.